I'm Dr. Kelly Brogan. You may know me as a New York Times bestselling author of a book with an exploding pill on the cover, renegade psychiatrist, pole dancer, or honorary member of the Disinformation Dozen. What can I say? I'm a born provocateur. I've spent most of my recent life exposing deceptions, connecting dots, and discovering the secret places my inner victim is still waiting to be liberated. And now, I feel called to help you reclaim all of your parts, your health, your sexuality, your power, and your expression, so that you can finally truly own yourself. I want to ignite in you that inner knowing and the pulsing vitality that lives beneath your disempowerment, disconnection, and resentment, so that you can audaciously, courageously, and playfully alchemize your struggle into the specific pleasure of who you are. This is Reclamation Radio. Hi, and welcome back to Reclamation Radio. I am Dr. Kelly Brogan, and I am here today with Alex Zeck, who happens to be one of my all-time favorite humans walking this plane. And if you don't know who he is, let's see, Alex, I'm going to call you a military man.
No longer, though, because people will use that against me sometimes.
Oh, okay. He's cool.
Still in the military.
I think it's cool. The founder of The Way Forward, which is also an epic, very truth-telling podcast. And somehow he has, you know, sort of slithered through all of the censorship grids in that forum, which I find extraordinary. And also one of the producers of End of COVID, which I was very excited to be a part of. And I learned about you really through Health Freedom for Humanity and the rise, you know, from whatever dark corner you were hiding in before that during the early days of the pandemic. And of course, I think many people at this point know that I have a beautiful karma with your family. And there's a couple of families from the days of my private practice that I have like woven like webs deeper into the matrix of the relations of my patients, and yours is one of them, because your mom is a very public former patient of mine who has an extraordinary reclamation story that we actually published in the medical literature, and it trickled, you know, this kind of inspiration, activation, remembrance, you know, trickled into your life and your wife's life, and it's been amazing, you know, to have contact with your sister and, you know, your greater umbrella of a family. And I consider you to be my source of interpretation for what is going on in the clown show. Like, you are who I look to help me to get like a quick and dirty interpretation of what I might need to know or think about or consider, since I have personally largely unsubscribed from the ticker tape of what the fuck is going on out there. Sometimes I'm still a little curious and I want to know Alex's take on it. So the reason, I mean, apart from just feeling, you know, like I trust your heart, it's also the way that your mind works and the way that your mind is anchored in really a lot of alchemical trauma work that you've clearly done, because you otherwise wouldn't be able to think without being unduly influenced, let's say, or without your thinking being distorted by the echoes of victim consciousness that stem from our traumas and our wounds. And obviously we're all susceptible at moments, but I really consider you to have great mastery in that realm at like, what are you, like 14? I mean, you're like literally like half my age. So it's amazing that you've
31, but close.
it's evidence, right? That there's something that my generation is really burdened with and bogged down by, that like these younger, I think younger and younger generations seem to have more alacrity with. So I would love to talk today, Alec, about thinking. And I've seen you do dozens of presentations on this subject. And I know you have like, you know, cool slideshows and all the rest. But today we're just going to chat about this very, you know, ontological, phenomenological subject. And I would like to start out. You were like, these are really big questions. You're going to be asking.
Yeah. Huge question. Alex Zeck is charged with answering, but okay.
Yes, yeah, we're hopping there. In the deep end. And I know you've got this. Hopping in the deep end. Because many of us, right? So we have some close homies in the collegial realm. And we gather, and many of us have concluded, you know, through our own journeys, through our own powers of observation and deductive reasoning, that we are in the midst of a thinking crisis, right? The world over. So when you consider that possibility, where do you think it starts? Like, do you think that there are, you know, like dark overlords casting hypnotic spells? Do you think that it's designed this way so that we can remember God? Like, do you think that we are, you know, indoctrinated in our, you know, Rockefeller-funded school systems, and that we lose our capacities and gifts and talents of perception? You know, what do you think of as like some of the origins of the problem that I have seen you focus on most, which is we have to reclaim our minds, right? Like, we have to reclaim our faculties. And, you know, here's how I know that, right? Like, here's how I know that this problem is a big one. Tell me about maybe like how you got turned on to this particular vantage point, right? Because you and I have blown the whistle about virology, and there's so many specific areas that you could focus on. But what I've seen you zoom out to really invite people to consider is that we have this thinking problem. So what do you think it's about?
What do I think is the origin of the thinking problem? So everything you mentioned there regarding like the dark overlords who are trying to do things to hinder our ability to think or manipulate us to think certain things, or this being fundamental aspect of how this reality works and we're just supposed to experience this. And then the third thing you said was the Rockefeller school system, which we know is based in the Prussian education model, which was overtly stated to create obedient workers for the government, essentially. And I think it's yes to all of that. It's yes to all of that. And the other thing that you pointed to with respect to trauma and alchemizing the traumatic experiences that you've had in this lifetime, I sort of look at that as a necessary precursor, whether it's something that occurred in this lifetime or in previous lifetimes, if you buy into that idea. I think it's something that is required in order to, you know, put you through the fire to cultivate the faculties to be able to see clearly what's going on in the world. And I think when you're taking all of those things that you mentioned into consideration, like I went through a lot of childhood trauma. My dad was very aggressive, let's say, and my mom was very neglectful. And it took some time for me to realize that, wow, my parents don't know shit. And I think that it can be very disorienting when you experience something like that. But then when you sort of take those, you know, thoughts, feelings, and beliefs that have accumulated through that experience, and you dissect them and you really give them a look inside of you, it helps you to see that the only true source of knowledge is inside of you. And this is like hinting at mysticism. And that's not to say we should throw empiricism and rationalism aside. That's not what it is. Because as you know, I'm very, very big in holding virology and the germ paradigm's feet to the fire when it comes to their so-called empirical claims. And I would consider myself a rational thinker, but it's pointing to something deeper. And it's this mystical element that can only be discovered inside of yourself. And I think it can only be discovered based on those traumatic experiences that have been alchemized. And am I complete in my alchemical processes? Absolutely not. Fuck no. Absolutely not. But I think if you're open to the journey of alchemy and you're willing to just be present with what is, I think you see the world as it truly is.
Yeah, I call it like sober eye, having sober eyes.
Yeah, having sober eyes. Yeah, that's a perfect way to describe it. And of course, all those other things that you named, the dark overlords, the reality that this is the way this reality works, and the Prussian education model, all of those things play into that reality, but they are all beautiful catalysts, or they can be, right? Beautiful catalysts to help us remember. That's it. I think that when you're open to that, you're truly open to that and you're not resisting it, you're open to what is, and you're open to the truth of what is. And then I think what helps is you have a mom and dad who you come to realize don't know shit. Then you also start looking at other so-called authority figures and you say, you don't fucking know shit either. You have no clue. So then it becomes a journey of questioning, how do you know what you claim to know? Any of it, everything. Like, there's nothing off the table. And I think for a lot of people, that can lead them to a position of nihilism where it's like, fuck, like, dude, we can't know anything. Why even try to know anything at all? And that's not the position that I come from. It's that they all claim to know, right? All these people claim to know. And I really think largely that they claim to know because they have not dealt with the things inside of them that I'm referring to, right? And because they haven't dealt with that, they're unable to sit in the uncertainty of not knowing. They have to cling on to something outside of them and cling to this knowledge. And I think when you are able to reconcile and wrestle and dance with the happenings inside of you, I think it, you know, allows you to see the world as it truly is, like I said. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, but. Yeah, for sure. And that, you know, in the psychobiology realm, you may know this already, but there's a term called neuroception, which is like your capacity, this interoception, which is your capacity to scan your body and be aware, bring awareness to the sort of signals of unsafety that are in your body. And then neuroception is your perception on the outside of safety, right? So danger and safety risk assessment. And, you know, and it, sometimes they use an example where it's like, you know, if you have a pile of laundry in the dim light of your bedroom, you might like have a whole somatic sequence unfold and be like, ah, there's like an intruder, right? It's going to like get me. And if you can like see clearly, you can see it's laundry and you have zero somatic sequence unfold. So how and where are those inner somatic sequences being triggered? It's the lens, right? It's like the virtual reality goggles like that we're looking through that are potentially being strategically manipulated, and you can take them off, right? So like you do have two hands to remove them, you know, metaphorically. And so how do we get to that place? So you may not know the answer to this, but like in your journey, in your process, do you think that like first you started to recognize that command of your thought apparatus was the first order of business? And then you started to see like, oh, wow, like there are a lot of ways I could think one thing if I was afraid and think another thing if I was less afraid or could hold my fear. And so what's the deal with fear? How about I work on that, right? Like, how about I work on my traumas and my, you know, wounds and my relationships and optimize that? Or did you start to do inner work? I think I know the answer, but like, did you
start? The answer is the latter, if I may jump in, because I can sit here and say it's very process related. Do you have like a diagram on your wall of how you think and how you determine something is true on a scale of 1 to 10, and you put it through this criteria, blah, 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 blah? No, I don't do any of that stuff. So it's almost like I feel imposter syndrome when people say, I really appreciate the way that you think. How do you think? And I'm like, I don't know how I think. I just know. I just know that the claims that they make about certain things aren't true. And I have this inner knowing that the best way to get to a, you know, more whole example of a certain truth is to unpeel or peel back all of the things that aren't true. That's it. And there are different methods that people use to determine whether something is true physically and metaphysically. When it comes to, you know, physically determining something is true, that's empiricism and rationalism, right? When it's metaphysically, you know, determining whether something is true, and this is where it can get a little bit sticky, that would be something like mysticism. And then there's a lot of more new age people out there who think that they're channeling the Pleiadians and things like this. I just don't buy into any of that stuff. And, you know, maybe for them in their little corner of reality, they may think that that is true. And that's okay, so long as their little corner is then not violently wielding itself against us. And at the same time, I fully believe that if they are able to do that, we attracted it. So it's like this weird dance of you know, and this weird interplay of all of us. And now in terms of how I think it was absolutely a result of experiencing trauma, like experiencing a lot of childhood trauma. And of course, people have experienced more trauma than me, but I experienced some pretty fucked up shit relative to most kids in Western countries. And for me, I am so grateful looking back at that because I know it has given me the capacity to see. And that's really all I can say about that.
Yeah. And perhaps because of your specific reaction formation, as we call it, like your response to the authority figures that were charged with your care, you know, there is an embedded, which of course I share, an embedded mistrust that is the foundation for thinking on your own. You know, I still imagine that there was some initiatory moment in your young life, you know, maybe around the early pandemic where, you know, there was like an ignition, right? Like, yeah, right. And because I think absent that sense of, you know, it's like your spine coming online, like you didn't, absent, obviously men are not initiated. You did go, you know, into a military environment. And I don't know if you would consider it that, but like there was some confluence of factors that resulted in your sense of personal responsibility and a capacity to mitigate the fear of speaking out that most people have, right? Because, you know, there were a few of us who came out the gate questioning not just, you know, what the shenanigans of the government, right? But questioning more deeply, you could say. And that led us to really, you know, sort of cohere around this virology germ theory reframe, shall we say. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, that to speak about that requires that you know, that you value your own truth, your own posture, your own authority more than you value connection, right? And whatever you get through this sense of being a part of the social fabric. And you know, we know people who know the truth and would rather not speak about it, which is, yeah, you got to meet yourself where you are. But there was something that turned on inside of you, obviously. And I wonder if you could speak a little bit to like, why do you think you got, it's probably present tense, you are so passionate about germ theory. Why do you think that, you know, sort of the virus evidence or lack thereof was something that became like a fulcrum for you, you know, that's really tipped you over into so many, and myself as well, into so many other points of inquiry, you know, like what do you think it is about that specific topic that really, yeah, sort of like started the ignition for you?
I think that the reason I became almost obsessive over this specific topic is because I saw that it was rooted in us having our power taken from us, not only power, but also ownership over our own lives. Because it was just another way that we could blame an external thing for our circumstances. And, you know, I had this realization the other day, and this is going to sound like, yeah, no duh for a lot of your audience, but it like really hit me at a deep level. Because I was struggling with some stuff related to some familial things. I was sitting in my sauna and I was like, that thing that happened to me is no longer present here with me now. The only thing that is real is the story about it in my mind. And is that even real? Is that really here right now with me? So the only thing that is perpetuating my own suffering at this point are my thoughts, feelings, and beliefs, and then subsequent actions based on those misaligned thoughts, feelings, and beliefs. And so from a sort of meta perspective, I look at anything in this reality that inhibits our ability from taking 100% ownership of ourselves. Because the germ quote theory, and it's a failed hypothesis, is one of those things that is rooted in misaligned beliefs, because it does not hold weight both, you know, rationally, empirically, or mystically, right? If you will, I'm sure, you know, a medical medium would say, well, my guides tell me that viruses were made, blah, 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 blah. But point is that you could sort of come at it on all three levels there, and it doesn't hold water in either of the three. But so it's just one of those examples, as is statism, that allows us to put the blame outside of ourselves, or, and really it's and or, allows us to latch on to something as a savior outside of ourselves. And I am fully convinced that my experiences in this life going forward, especially as I become aware, are based in my own thoughts, feelings, beliefs, and actions. And damn, is that empowering, but also damn, is that fucking scary, because there's no one to blame anymore for your circumstances except for you. And I think a lot of people can take this sort of David Goggins approach of like, harden up, motherfucker, like no one's coming to save you. But I think it's there's some compassion there too for the lack of awareness up to this point, and for the reality that, you know, we're in this reality that has a lot of presentation for various trauma-based catalysts that are challenging. And I'm not saying that we should just like in the moment, you know, when something, let's say like our kid dies or something like that, just be like, oh, fuck it, I need to reorient my thoughts, feelings, beliefs. That's not it. You feel them. You feel the things as they are, and you feel them to completion. But then you get to the point that you have to reorient your lives and sort of transmute that thing. And once you felt it to completion, to use it to birth something better. And that's how I look back on all of my trauma. I'm like, I could very easily continue to blame for how I am presenting right now, right? But that doesn't serve me. That doesn't serve me. And that's where I have gotten to a place where I genuinely look back on my trauma and I'm like, I am so grateful, genuinely grateful for that experience, for those experiences. And again, it's this power that you cultivate inside of you to know that I am creating this experience for myself. Like, I am actively creating this based on my daily thoughts, feelings, beliefs, and actions. So that's kind of why I've tackled this. And I think the layer below that is it's just rooted in total bullshit. It's very clearly not true. And it's, again, used in a way to weaponize, in a weaponized fashion, to get us to do all those things that I just mentioned before. So that's why I've latched onto it. And then I think that it goes back to what I had said previously regarding being able to sit with not knowing. Like, I look at that as an exercise that is extremely fun for me to be like, wow, none of them know shit. I don't really know that much. I have a sense of what is true. I know that all the things that they're pointing to are complete bullshit, though, and I'm just going to explore and try to figure out what's true and analyze every single claim that they make about history, about science, about physics, about all of it. And that's fun.
So I like to sweat. I live in Miami and I don't always eat locally. And fun fact, I don't love supplements, like capsule supplements. So because I also know that mineral deficiency is a major driver of imbalance, weight gain, excessive hunger, and fatigue, I love finding and experimenting with therapeutic foods that I can incorporate into my routine. So I'm super excited about Samadhi sea moss that my friend found at a local farmer's market. It's small batched sea moss that comes from Caribbean divers. So the company works directly with these divers who harvest only the cleanest sources. So it's never creepily farmed or anything like that. It has over 90 bioavailable vitamins and minerals, and it's my new favorite addition to my self-care regimen. So I take a tablespoon once or twice a day, and I wash it down with lemon water. It actually tastes like nothing, which is fantastic. And I noticed a shift in how I felt after 1 week, specifically in terms of digestion. So I'd love to share it with you. They're offering 10% off for y'all with the code Kelly10. So check out the link in show notes. It is fun. That's what I've come to. I think you would agree, is that the truth, when you dig deep enough and you peel back, as you said, enough of those layers of deception, the truth feels good, right? Like where you arrive when you defrag the germ hypothesis programming is alignment with your body, the experience of deep meaning expressed through your symptoms, and a total resolution of the contamination consciousness that says, and somebody's going to do something bad to me. And, you know, what we have seen is that you can dig a layer, right? And you can get to this layer where I think Amanda Vollmer refers to it as the double cross, right? Like you can go a little bit deep and you can say, oh, I get it now. Like there are these bad people who are doing this bad stuff to us, right? Like they've engineered this virus, and that is what we have to expose. That truth feels terrible. That feels just as bad as some like natural biological phenomenon, right? And when you go the layer deeper, right? So like, you know, I think she used like the JFK example, like, you know, when you think the CIA killed him versus when you think the whole, he's still on an island somewhere or whatever. Like when you go deep enough and you ask deep enough questions, like you can arrive at a place where it actually feels good. And, you know, that's true for a lot of the cosmological questioning, is a lot of people who've, you know, we've seen who've questioned the nature of, you know, this, the programming around the solar system and NASA and all this stuff. Like you get to this deep reconnection to like awe and inspiration. Like, I don't know how anybody else explains that when they get to the, what we'll call the true earth, you know, perspective on things, it just feels better, right? Like you're reconnected to, you know, if you want to call it God, whatever you want to, you know, refer to.
It feels much more meaningful.
Meaningful, yeah. And divine and infused with something that feels like design, you know? So.
Can I comment on that real quick?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
I think for the genuine seeker, right? When we're peeling back these things that are untrue, that people claim, whether it's the mainstream or the alternative side, it's the subtle feeling, and at least for me, I can only speak my own experience, is a subtle feeling inside of me where it's like, that's not it. And then I throw it away. I throw it to the side and I'm like, okay, there's a layer deeper. And I get to that and I'm like, that's still not the complete picture. And what it's rooted in, it's like I'm being pulled by this feeling inside of me that knows what the truth is, but I can't articulate it. I can't speak it. Words won't do it justice. There's something inside of me that is a more like meta, larger truth of the way things work, the way things are, and how all of these pieces fit together. And it cannot be articulated. But the only way we can articulate it is by continually falsifying the things that any group says is true. And it's pulling and saying, okay, yeah, maybe this, now that I've gone 10 layers deeper on this specific topic, this is a piece of it, but this isn't the full picture. There's some deeper truth here. And then just continuing to explore that. And I think that is the journey itself. Like that is the whole point. That is literally the whole point of it all. And I don't know that in this lifetime, we will ever get to supreme knowledge on anything, but I don't think that's not the purpose of it. I think it's just to continue to be on the journey of unraveling and pointing, orienting ourselves towards what is true, but never actually being able to reach it in this experience.
Absolutely. And it's the phenomenological nature of remembrance, you know, that it feels something like you described, and it's not very charged, right? So when I've had huge charge, you know, around my truth telling, which of course I have personally had, you know, publishing books with exploding pills on the cover and all the rest. I've always been arrested in that layer we were just referring to, where it was still warfare consciousness. It was still projected bad mommy daddy business. And as I've gone deeper and deeper into, you know, what you're describing is this maturation, I would call it, of victim consciousness into like sovereign consciousness, it just feels totally different. There's almost like this kind of like, I don't know, like a mischievous kind of like smile about it. It's like, wow, okay, this is, yeah, okay, bring it on. And I think that one of the tools that you have in your holster that helps to drain the charge and the projection from this otherwise, you know, very potentially perilous field, you know, that is like, it's like a minefield of places you could step on and take personally, right? Like so many dimensions of what is being discussed in terms of these polarizing topics. And the tools that you bring to the table that I have found, like I refer to the way you talk about it all the time, is the logical fallacies, right? It's like one of the, in the year that I homeschooled, that was like literally what I taught my kids was the, you know, Tuttle Twins, logical fallacies books. And I'm not sure there's anything else you really need to know except how to not take the bait of, you know, fancy rhetoric that is potentially simultaneously in service of deceiving the speaker and the listener. So I wonder, you know, and I know you've spoken about this, that nauseam, but I wonder if you could give like a couple of the highlights of the logical fallacies that you think really clarified things for you in the virology realm as probably one of the best examples of where logical fallacies live, just so that somebody who's like never heard of even that phrase will begin to start to generate awareness as they're listening to people talk about, you know, contagion, infection, and the existence of this fictitious entity.
Yeah. So before I do that, I think it's important to clarify if someone is looking for a framework of, I guess, how I think if I had to, and this isn't the full picture, ironically, but this isn't the full picture. Like I can't really describe how I think, but I think these three things, again, empiricism, rationalism, and then mysticism. So empiricism, when let's say within the context of virology or really any claims about something occurring in the natural world, employ the scientific method to determine if that thing is the cause of another thing. So you have an observed natural phenomenon occurring and you want to know whether the thing you think is the cause is the actual cause of that observed natural phenomenon. So that would be employing empiricism, which is, you know, the scientific method. Then when it comes to rationalism, like again, it's in my mind, the definitions for rationalism and the definitions for a rational, coherent argument don't really do justice or a service to any of us to really sufficiently explain what a coherent argument is. Pretty similar to what I was saying earlier, the best way to determine what is a rational argument is to be able to point out all the irrational arguments, which is where you'd employ, you know, logical fallacies to be able to recognize when things are not rational. And I guess the last category, like I said, is mysticism, and that requires that you do a lot of transmutation of your own trauma in order to be able to listen inward. And I think it's like a constellation of all three of those things that I employ to figure out whether something is true or pointing to something that is more true. So for logical fallacies, the ones that I see most often with respect to virology, I would say are appeals to authority, of course, which that's an easy one when you're citing an authority figure's position or a body of a governing body's position on something as, you know, your argument. The biggest one, though, I would say is a reification fallacy. And that's where you're assigning characteristics to something that is still fundamentally abstract. You're saying that a virus mutates. You're saying that a virus requires a culture. You're saying that a virus causes X, Y, and Z set of symptoms. That's what's called a reification fallacy. And the reason that it's that is because a virus is still an abstract concept. It's not a thing that has been concretely proven to exist or do anything in reality whatsoever. And that's where you would have to refer back to empiricism to be able to see if viruses have been proven to exist and cause illness, right? And I mean, how do you know whether something exists in reality or not? You could go really deep on this topic and be like, again, that kind of leads to nihilism where it's like, how do we know that any of this exists, right? But you have to go with, you have to have a foundational starting point, right? Like, I know I exist. I know my kids exist. For the sake of this experience, I can touch my kids. I can hold my kids, right? Dr. Cowan provides the example of being able to take a hammer out of a toolbox. I can take the hammer by itself away from all the other tools inside the toolbox to then use the hammer. So when it comes to viruses, they've never been demonstrated to exist, ever. They've always just been assumed to exist. And I think that this leads you down a path, and this has happened to me, where when I take the scientific method as an example, and then again, all the logical fallacies, and I'll come back to this, I'm making a longer point here. When I take the scientific method and paint it against, or just set it against virology's methods to determine the existence and causation in disease symptoms of a virus, it doesn't hold water. And then what, you know, as a molecular biologist has said to me, they'll say, well, then you must think all of cell biology is totally bullshit because we employ a lot of the same methods in virtually all of cell biology and all of molecular biology and microbiology. And my answer to that is yes, absolutely, right? Because we're taking these creations of man, these tools, right? These technologies, and I'm not saying that they don't have some positive benefits in their use, but that are inherently flawed. And then we're attempting to take something, in this case, excising tissue, and then taking snot from a sick person and taking them out of their natural context in natural observable reality, and then mixing them with a bunch of other things and thinking that that informs us on what is happening in natural reality. And it's just absurd, right? So the other ones that I come across to are the burden of proof fallacy. And this is a huge one when it comes to logic. And this is actually a maxim of law. The burden of proof lies on the one presenting the positive claim. So the positive claim in this case, in the case of virology, is that viruses exist and cause illness. So the burden of proof is on the individuals who are making that claim to provide evidence for said claim. I can't prove that viruses don't exist, like I can't prove that unicorns don't exist or that garden gnomes with lasers for eyes don't exist. I can't prove any of that. The burden of proof lies on those who are presenting the claim. And I'd say the other one that I see quite a bit too, especially amongst the health freedom community, is the affirming the consequent logical fallacy, where they'll say something to the effect of, I know the virus exists because I was sicker than I've ever been, or I had symptoms of illness, therefore that is proof of the virus. If you're claiming that X exists and causes Y, you need to establish empirically evidence that X exists and causes Y. You can't point to Y, the effect, the observed natural phenomenon, people getting sick, even multiple people getting sick in the same space with similar symptoms, as proof of X absent of establishing a causative relationship between X and Y. And I see so many people, especially in the health freedom community, do that. I know it was an engineered virus because I had symptoms that I've never had before. And it's, I mean, obviously it's extremely illogical, but there are countless other explanations for what causes this phenomenon. This is, again, an exercise in, I have no clue. I can't say with certainty what causes, let's say, someone to lose their taste and smell for 18 months. I have no idea. Do I deny that that phenomenon is real? No, I don't deny it. And I would say, unfortunately, there's a lot of people who become so glued to thinking that they know with certainty that it is this thing sort of in the train camp. They're like, you know, I think that's all in your head. But for some people that I know, it's not really, quote, all in their head. This is something that they've experienced. And these are people that have known since 2015, 2016, that viruses have never been shown to exist and that gain of function is a PSYOP. And they still experience extended loss of taste and smell. But then this is where it becomes an exercise of being able to sit in the I don't know and be okay with the I don't know and continue as things come into your awareness of dissecting them and sitting with them and saying, is this a piece of the puzzle? Is this a piece of the picture? Is this pointing to something that is deeper and more true? If not, throw it aside. Nope, that's not it. If yes, okay, let's hold on to this and let's go deep into this topic. And I think that a lot of people struggle with that.
Yeah. If it's not what you're saying it is, then what is it, right? That you have to have all of these package, prepackage, replacement theories in order to question and even interrogate, like with the intention to expose what might not be internally consistent, the original posited theory.
Can I say one more logical fallacy real quick? The other one that's really big, and this kind of plays into the affirming the consequent, because affirming the consequent is a form of circular reasoning, but it's when your premise already has the conclusion baked into it. And that one, virology is riddled with that. So that would be the other one that I see pretty often. I mean, there are so many logical fallacies that we could get to with respect to virology, but that one is another key one too. Sorry to interrupt.
No, it's perfect. I think it has like a Latin name, petitio principi or something. It's like where you're already assuming that what you're testing is real as you're testing it. And, you know, people would be surprised how often that is. I think, you know, when I zoom out, I think that most, you know, if you want to call them lay people, whatever, people who aren't otherwise exposed to like bench scientific research or, you know, the hallowed halls of these, you know, Ivy League institutions, et cetera, to imagine that there would be very intelligent people, it's like the pyramid scheme, right? Very intelligent people going to their job, you know, in the morning, that are participating in this house of cards, right? That are participating in all of these illusory assumptions, like these gross assumptions. They're like, come on, like, how could that be the case? Like, somebody would have exposed that by now. And that's like often the thinking that allows us to abdicate responsibility for inquiry, right? Like you're just like, if there was more to see here, we would have already seen it and too many people are in on it. But you and I know, because, you know, and you've spoken to more actual researchers and scientists in this realm than I certainly have, you know that, yes, they are intelligent people. And yes, there are foundational assumptions that have never been questioned because we're in this myopic place of like looking at these little, and I've done bench research. I actually participated in virological research at Rockefeller University. I mean, back in the days of my med school training, and all I had to do was like pipette this serum from one little plastic bottle to the other and then, you know, see what happened. And so when you're in the granular details and nobody's asking the bigger picture questions, it's very easy to imagine that there are millions of people who are reifying this every single day. And that's why nobody's ever asked.
Well, I look at it with my military experience, right? Luckily, I've never served in combat, but I've been involved in planning for either training operations or to some degree what would have been just real deployment operations, non-combat deployment operations, but nonetheless deployment operations. And there, when you're immersed in your specific job and it's compartmentalized, you're doing that job and you think it's legitimate and you trust the people are your left and right are doing their specific jobs and there's some crossover and communication between the two, but you are fully bought into what you're doing without, let's say in this case, ever questioning the foundational assumption that are there actually terrorists in Iraq and Afghanistan? Like how many people stop to question that? There are some who do, but then because the people to the left and their right are continuing on with their work, they're like, well, you know, I'm just a guy with limited knowledge, limited capacity. You know, someone knows better than I do, and I'm doing my specific role, and I'm pretty good at it, so I'm just going to continue on doing it. There must be something that I don't know about this. Instead of stopping to think and say, wait, where have they proved this foundational claim? And when you're the one person who pops their head up to say that, especially, you know, in this society, if you're wanting to stay in the system, for lack of a better term. But within the confines of that experience, you're going to, you know, be...
There are
going to
be consequences, perhaps.
There's going to be some major consequences for you speaking. And that is what prevents people from going on this inward journey of... And it's when you're immersed in a field, let's say for virology, the cognitive dissonance associated with having to reconcile the reality that your whole field in the fields that are, you know, adjacent to your own, that complement your own, are completely nonsense is too hard for many people to wrestle with. And I have compassion for that. Do I think that there's this grand scheme where all virologists are in on it and they know the truth and they're just not telling us? That is absurd. And, you know, it's like those claims that I see coming from people in the health freedom space too, where they're like, oh, so you really expect us to believe that all virologists are in on it? I'm like, when you were waking up to this whole COVID thing, did you think all doctors were in on it? Or was it simply that they were taught this and they never questioned the foundational assumption?
So people love to ask me questions, and I love to ask questions of others because inquiry is play. But some of my interviews and answers are too hot to handle for Reclamation Radio. So in my membership, Vital Life Project, I have created a private podcast that gets delivered to wherever you listen to podcasts, where I answer your questions that arise because of my provocative subject matter. And I also share interviews that might otherwise be censored that I call the Sovereignty Series. So you'll get access to these private podcasts and a private chat by joining my membership, Vital Life Project. I'll see you in there. And you've come, I think, to the same paradigmatic issues with politics, right? Because, you know, you and I have seen some folks who can question biologically, let's say, you know, who can go to the places you're suggesting we go foundationally with inquiry. And then, you know, partisan politics, you know, comes up and the circus rolls into town, and you know, they're jumping on the, you know, the RFK bandwagon or whatever else. And I imagine you would suggest that there's like a level of depth of inquiry that is probably necessary in that case.
You brought up this constellation, right? Of like, if you believe in the germ paradigm from a health freedom health freedom person who believes in the germ paradigm, you are probably likely to believe in politics too. I am willing to bet 99 times out of 100 that will be the case. And it's because it's rooted in the same framework for reality, in that you're unwilling to go deeper and continue questioning assumption after assumption and claim after claim. And again, I don't know what makes us unique, Kelly. I was just talking about this with Tom on an episode that I recorded with him, where it's like, we're willing to go there. It's not a fearful exercise for me to question the foundational assumption. Like in this case for politics, people are like, oh, we need to vote RFK in because RFK would be a better candidate, instead of questioning the foundational assumption. And not only questioning it, but living by it. Like, is it true that men have the right to dictate the lives of other men? Or, you know, men and women have the right to dictate the lives of other men and women without them expressing that they have that right? No. Like, who gives them that right? Who gives them that right? Where was it? And even if it was written, what is the foundation for that, you know, paradigm? And there are so many in the health freedom space that are unwilling to question that foundational assumption and actually live by it.
Right. Who are otherwise interested in consent, right? And contracts, right? Like lucid contracts. Yeah. The diathesis, as I call it, because I've been studying this and watching it, because there are so many people who I would otherwise have like spiritual interests in common with, or even, you know, sort of activist related interests. Cause I find that the dots that I've connected, right? So it's so-called anti-vaxxers, right? So whatever, I don't really mind that slur. People get, you don't want to be associated with it. I call myself that all the time. Fine. So people who are advocating for vaccine choice, let's say, right? They are also very focused on, simultaneously, on the engineered virus theory of the pandemic, They also are very concerned about parasites and Lyme disease. Very, like, to the point of obsessive.
And dormant Epstein-Barr virus I'd throw in there, too.
Throw it in there. And they believe in globe cosmology, right? So they believe in conventional. So, and people might be like, who cares? Like, what does that have to do with anything? It has to do. Okay.
It does. Absolutely.
And they are voting for RFK. Right. So, like, and not to be dehumanizing, like, you know, this is some sort of like meta monster or something. But I have been curious, like, what is the description of the layer of consciousness that is captured by these dominant thought forms that I just listed? And the only thing that I can come up with, and I think you would agree, is that this is its victim consciousness cloaked in sovereignty, right? So it's like a trickster. It's like a trickster realm where you've made the poor bargain, right? Like, you've taken the poison apple. You have imagined yourself. Isn't there some quote that's like, you know, no one is more enslaved than somebody who imagines they're free, kind of a thing? Like, where you tell yourself, oh, I've jailbroken myself, and you've just fallen like one layer deeper. But the resonance of us versus them, the resonance of the zero sum game, the resonance of like,
disempowerment.
I am actually, yes, fundamentally disempowered, and I will take it back, right? It's the adolescent fight with the vilified parents who were once idealized. And it's a trap. It is a trap. And I would go, without sounding like what I've actually become, which is a moral relativist, without sounding, you know, like I have abdicated any sort of inner compass around ethics, the good evil split, it's very problematic. It's very problematic. And that's why I think sometimes, you know, Christian believers, let's say, can fall into this second layer where there is like this fight against evil.
Right.
And if you want to get, you know, psychological about it, it's possible that it's just another way that we're projecting our own shadow parts. You know, it's just another projection screen. It's like you have the mainstream projection screen, you know, that you can get told about on Fox and NBC. And then you have this alt projection screen where you're still putting out all of your heinous attributes, all of your capacity to you know, harm others and do the bad things. And you've personified it in parasites and viruses and government, bad governments and, you know, pedos and all the things. And the cosmology piece is there too, right? Because you fundamentally still believe that we are, you know, spinning on a dead rock in the middle of nowhere, having been conceived through a big bang or whatever, and looking to NASA to tell us about, you know, what is the nature of this realm. And so there's something that ties together all of those perspectives that, you know, you and I and our colleagues are like a relatively small and uncomfortably small group of folks who don't subscribe to any of it. Just so happens, right? Like, we don't subscribe to any of those particular perspectives. And I don't otherwise know how to explain it, because do you think it's a thinking thing? Do you think it's a spiritual thing?
It's both, because
it's
again,
those three that you're saying, I guess.
Yes,
right?
It's those three. It's the empiricism, the rationalism, and I hate, God, I hate applying like, you know, specific, like, oh, these three categories. It feels very machinistic, and it's not that, but it's like a crossover of all three of those things. And like, I think that, let me think of how I want to articulate this, because it's really hard to articulate it. And I think you know what I mean. It's just hard to articulate what it is, like what the difference is. And it's victimhood, but it's victimhood cloaked in sovereignty, like in under the guise of sovereignty, but it's deeper than that. It's, yeah, I don't even know. I don't even know how to articulate it.
So when you meet someone, you know, you're out at a rave, as you are, no, I'm kidding, like wherever, like, yeah, wherever you might meet someone, right? So
I've got my 3-year-old in a maybe Bjorn.
So when you're out in the world and you encounter somebody, and let's say like, okay, so let's say you're like at a conference or something, and you know that you have some shared interest, but you're like not totally sure whether or not you are touching into that constellation we've referenced or not. What are the things that you look for in terms of how you can perceive somebody to be as a thinker.
Yeah. I think it all goes back to like willingness and ability to sit comfortably in uncertainty and be totally okay with that. And really having like nothing is off the table to question, like nothing, like being willing to openly question all of it and being totally okay with that. Like, I just have a feeling, let's say when I go to a gathering in Austin, that there are certain camps where like I have this feeling inside of me where I probably shouldn't bring that up because I can just tell by the way these people think that that topic may be too far for them to explore just by the way that they're articulating their so-called knowledge of other things. And it's that. And I think a level of humility too, and being able to sit like there are a lot of people, especially quote influencers, who want to come across with this certainty that they know with certainty that something is as it is. And they get attached to that specific set of beliefs. And I think those are the two things.
Yeah. I mean, I guess a nuance is that I've experienced, and so have you, is like somebody can be open, which I agree is a right. And I would call that, because I like to think in terms of like polarity and woundology, like I think until you've done some basic father wound work, like you don't know how to be wrong. You literally don't know how to be wrong. So, you know, if that openness comes from having a more matured concept of what being wrong is, right? And you have the capacity to say, I don't know, because you don't imagine that it would make you a bad and wrong person if you thought something that then later you thought differently about. Okay, so if somebody's open-minded, fantastic. But then you and I have both presented information to an open-minded person, and it's just like literally gone in one ear and out the other. Like it's not taken root. And they might even say like, oh yeah, okay, yeah, totally about, you know, of course about the virus thing, or yeah. And then you'll hear them speaking and referencing said virus that you just talked to them. It's like, what happened? The information wasn't enough. And so that's why it's like, when you and I are looking at these, like these thought form webs, I think it's really important to consider, because it's like, one little disrupted piece can't live by itself, right? It's going to collapse back into a victim consciousness field, even if it's dressed up, you know, as being emancipated. If the whole thought form field web doesn't come with it, and that's a lot to ask, right? Because essentially when you're saying, hey, might you consider the fact that a virus has never been isolated? Like actually what you're asking is like, you know, are you ready to go on like the most horrific plant medicine ceremony unattended by any curandero you've ever been on, you know, like because your entire, the fabric of your reality is about to melt, and you have to sustain the liminal space in between realities, right? Like where we don't necessarily have a replacement one to tuck you into. And of course, you know, you and I have been discussing that you sort of like wake up out of the anesthesia, and it's confusing and disorienting and scary. And very quickly, like it becomes okay. And you actually learn that that's where your navigational orientation comes from, is the okayness, as you said many times, like with the okayness with not knowing the thing, but now having an apparatus where you can reliably question what is put in front of you. You can discern, and then there are choose, right? And I've just found it fascinating, like how many of our colleagues, like, get one layer and just don't get it in so many others, or they get it for a minute and then they forget and they're talking about viruses again and contagion and be careful and take your...
I've had that experience. Yeah. There's this one doctor that I know she's gone back and forth so many times, even on her own page, where she'll make claims about viruses and virology and then immediately flip, or make very empowering claims about us being in a symbiotic relationship with so-called parasites, and then a week later be making posts on parasite cleanses and things like this. And I think what you're pointing to regarding the victim consciousness that permeates this sort of how do you say that word again? Diathesis?
Oh, diathesis. Yeah, diathesis. I think it's like a medical term. I like weave them in. I don't even know.
Okay. Maybe that's why I've never heard of it before. I'm like, that's a medical thing.
I don't know. But
luckily, I wasn't indoctrinated into that camp. But it is rooted in victimhood in many ways. And I think that's why, as you're dissecting these various claims, employing those three things, again, if you want a framework, it, for me, in my life, in my own experience, has all pointed back to self-ownership, 100% self-ownership and self-responsibility being the key out of the matrix, if you will. Like, that's it. And that's why there's some people who wake up to the virology thing and some then they don't get the politics thing. But again, that's very rare that someone truly wakes up to the virology thing and understands it at a deep level that, again, is informed in the reality, because that's what you have to come to terms with, that, whoa, holy shit, my health is almost 100% a function of my own thoughts, feelings, beliefs, and actions, right? And at the least, if there are some things out there, like shit that they're spraying in the sky, things like that, right? Or 5G towers, whatever. It is still 100% my responsibility to deal with it, right? And someone who gets that, because that's what you get to when you continue to peel back virology, again, above the superficial, and I consider it superficial now, oh, virus hasn't been isolated. There's deeper elements to be found there. And when you get to those deeper elements, you cannot possibly, if you're truly embodying them, then also think that, ah, the best way for me to experience freedom in my own life is to vote, or is to do any of these other things related to politics. You can't possibly have that. There's just no way. There's no consistency in that framework. And that's ultimately what it is. It's the subtle elements of victimhood that are still present in you, where you think that there are things outside of you that are coming to get you. Ironically, if you believe that and then act upon it, you will create scenarios where that is true. But where you not only think that, but you are also orienting your life in such a way that it creates more of it, like I said. But there's one other piece. It's that you're orienting your life in such a way that there are things outside of you that are coming to get you, and or, like I said earlier, there are things that are coming to save you outside of you. It's rooted in both of those things, that there are things that are coming to get you, and likewise, there are things coming to save you. When all of that, both of those across the spectrum, occur within you, like it all comes back to 100% ownership and responsibility over your thoughts, feelings, beliefs, and actions. And as we are employing these three frameworks to take their various claims of what is and passing them aside, it's like that's another lens that we can sort of filter them through, these various claims, aside from the, you know, empiricism, rationalism, and then this like mystical inner knowing. Two other things to apply is this rooting me, like putting me back into the camp that believes there are things outside of me coming to save me? And or is this putting me back in the camp that believes there are things outside of me coming to get me, coming to harm me? And if those two things, if those two categories are, and you know, in addition to these other three, are checked off, then it's probably bullshit.
Yeah, because that's literally like it's so helpful. And it's the definition of the victim triangle, right? Where you have, there's the villain out there you're pointing at, and you're waiting for your rescuer, right? And so you can sit comfortably in your victimhood. And you've heard me run my mouth about how, you know, I think angry activists are like themselves some of the greatest purveyors of victim consciousness, right? Because we not only, we are embodying the villain and out for blood, you know, from the enemy we're obsessed with, but then we're also reifying the powerlessness of the victim that we imagine we're, you know, standing for, who would never be able to do it without us. And there's so much of a, just like the allopathic, you know, sort of model, you're perpetuating exactly that which you're purporting to resolve, just like a good pharmaceutical, right? You are creating the problem in a long-term fashion, you know, that you are claiming you're going to resolve, the acid blockers, the antidepressants, whatever, this is what they do. And that's why I think it is really helpful to have the tools of rationalism to recruit them back into the field to it's like piercing holes in these hypnotic veils that otherwise are very they're powerful and they're lasting, and it's like you can't ever expect somebody to just peel it back. It's a very tall order. So that's why I think, you know, you and I walk the world and we're just feeling, you know, we're feeling for like who might be on this tip, because you know, we can play the game of the debate, right? I know you've done it. I do not play the debate game, right? Like you can go and you know, Tom and Andy, and you can gather y'all and the Baileys, and we can do that.
I don't really have much interest for it anymore at all, though. Like that was maybe a year ago. Not anymore. Like I have no desire to try to prove that to anyone on that side. I don't give two shits. Like I don't care.
I mean, unless you're offering like a suite of trauma healing therapies in addition to your discourse, like yeah, there's not going to be yield. And, you know, not to reduce it just to trauma, but to your point, that's one of the major infrastructural, you know, elements of our thoughts and beliefs. And so I'm with you. I'm so grateful, you know, to have you as a brother and an ally and a friend. And I would love for you to share what's like alive for you now. Cause I know, you know, that you kind of migrate your way as I do through related, you know, reclamation themes. And also there are things that you're kind of sick of talking about and probably have humored me in this hour.
And then I get invited to speak on it somewhere and I'm like, well, shit, maybe there are other people who need to continue to hear this and that's okay. But like my thing that I'm really, really excited about now that I'm sort of moving into and I've become obsessed with it is it's going to sound like, oh, okay. Occult knowledge, but occult knowledge on alchemy, like on metaphysical alchemy. That is where I'm like obsessed lately. And that's like all I'm reading. That's all I'm looking into, because I think that's where the rubber meets the road, so to speak. Like you brought up this example of an activist who is perpetuating a lot of the same things that they claim to be opposing. And it's like what occurred to me in that moment is, if they just stopped and paused and realized that this traumatic experience is the medicine itself, and what they're doing by continually pointing is resisting the medicine. They're just poisoning themselves further. They're taking that initial act, you could say, of poisoning and just poisoning themselves more instead of using that and transmuting it, alchemizing it inside of them to turn it into medicine for a gift for themselves and for others. And that's where I'm at right now. And I guess how that presents itself is not really going to tie in, but what I'm doing with the way forward is we're in the middle of launching the second version of our platform, where if you, let's say you listen to this episode and this sounds like, you know, Kelly and I seem like the type of people you'd want to associate with, just in the way that we think and the way that we express ourselves, we have a membership platform where you can type in your zip code and find like-minded people who are interested in the same things near you. And just with the 800 some odd members that we have up to this point, we like virtually every one of them is like that. They get it. And I feel so blessed to be surrounded by people who just get it. And I don't know what it is, but they get it.
The ineffable resolution of that isolation that we experienced probably from the cutting of the cord as infants, right? And looking for that experience of belonging that we can confer to each other. And it probably has something to do with coming into, you know, resonant fields that are represented by these beliefs. And I love what you're describing. And that's really interesting. I'll have to talk to you on a future pod about the occult exploration. That's exactly where I have found myself as well, you know, for this
right
reason.
Now?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Dear, I'll jam on this with you. It's like pretty much what I'm exploring in my spare time is exactly like what is known about metaphysical alchemy and how to work with, you know, our own.
Literally obsessed, like obsessed with it right now. That's all I care about.
I love it. I love it, Alex. So good to talk to you. And yeah, we'll make sure that people know how to get in on that that crew in the show notes. And to be continued.
Thanks, Kelly.